You're listening to the We Lead Well podcast, where well-being matters. This episode is brought to you in partnership with Transform Education Coaching, headteacherchat.com and the Teach Well Alliance. Enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to another episode of the We Lead Well podcast. I am Vicky Maguire, an education and leadership coach. I work with school leaders to support them to improve their own well-being and that of all their staff. I also run group coaching programmes for women leaders to help them to gain self-confidence and self-belief and think about where they're going, set goals and think about what actions they need to take to get there. And more recently, I've created the Women Lead Well Coaching Network to provide a supportive network for female school leaders. If you are interested in being part of either of those women leaders programs, the network or the group coaching program, please don't hesitate to email me at vicky@weleadwell.co.uk and we can have a chat about whether they would be suitable for you to join. So today on the show, I've got an interview with Dr. Kenny Frederick. Kenny is just amazing. I absolutely loved talking to her. Her approach to leadership in schools is really quite refreshing. She was a head teacher for 17 years on the Isle of Dogs in London. And from what I can gather from the conversation that we had, this was not an easy role to take on. There were challenges that she had to face. She's undergone a number of Ofsted inspections in her role in leadership in schools. And I wanted to really have a conversation with her about Ofsted and about the impact that that's having on staff and leaders in schools at the moment and about whether there might be an alternative to Ofsted that would be more supportive and potentially help schools to improve better than the current iteration of it. Kenny's also, she's got a PhD from Brunel University in teacher rounds. She'll tell us more about that in the interview as well. Kenny now works in consultancy and she also works to support head teachers and she's very passionate about giving teachers a voice. She'll tell us all about the work that she does with Headrest, which is an organisation to support head teachers, in the interview. You're going to really enjoy this one, I'm sure. So here she is, Kenny Frederick. Kenny Frederick, welcome to the We Lead Well podcast. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. Probably better than most people who are working in schools at the moment every day.
Yes, but I'm good. So I think from what I can gather, it's a real slog at the minute in schools, isn't it?
It is. I work as a consultant now. I'm in and out of schools all the time. And I've been doing lots of work for Headrest as a volunteer. And I'm hearing some terrible tales. And people are just on their last legs. This has been the hardest term for people. Never mind the last 2 years.
I know.
I think it's been the hardest.
So you're a consultant now, and I know you work for Headrest. I'm going to hopefully ask you a little bit about that in the interview. But can you just give the listeners a little bit of, tell us a little bit about yourself and your career, what you did and how you've ended up doing what you do now?
By chance, I started teaching in 1974, so I'm very old, in Tottenham. I was a cert ed teacher, whatever the word was then. I didn't do a degree because I had to get out and work. I was had a long story. My history was, you know, things weren't good and I had to earn money and so on. So I did that. I've no memory of teacher training. Went in, had no ambition certainly to be a head because they did something. My first head, I seemed to disappear off to play golf in different afternoons and he was in another world, anyway. The second head was slightly better, but I really didn't push myself forward at all. Just got on with the job, did my teaching, had a baby, came back. And then my head at the time, I think he'd taken over the two schools that had amalgamated and they didn't quite know what to do with me. I'd applied for heads of year jobs, didn't get them. And they thought, what are we going to do with her? So it was in the olden days, he sent me off on a secondment for a year. Can you imagine?
Wow.
To the Institute of Education, where I did a diploma in pastoral care, counselling and welfare and education. But that changed my life. because I'm working with lots of different people who come from different schools, who had a different view on, really educated me. And it was they, and being there, Chris Watkins was the guy who was leading the course. It really just helped me to grow and develop and reflect. And then when it came to go back to school time, I applied for a job, which was a head of house in a school that was quite near mine, but it was a big jump in salary. I had no experience of it. And I got the job with nobody more surprised than me. But it's a job I loved and never regretted it. From there, then again, I was quite happy. You know, if I'm given my head, you know, what went on behind the head's office, as far as I was concerned, they were talking about the Education Act 1944. I don't know. Nothing to do with me. And then it wasn't, I had a deputy head who we used to clash quite a bit. And he said to me one day, "You're too emotional, Kenny Hearn," as I was at the time, Kenny Frederick. He said, "You're too emotional. You'll never be a senior leader."
Ooh.
Well, I thought, blow you. Well, I said other words. And I started applying. And lo and behold, I went from, it was like it would have been a head of house, to get a deputy head's role in a girls' school in Hackney. And nobody was more surprised than me to actually deputy head me. You know, imposter syndrome has been around for years. Anyway, I got that role and I went on, and it was in a girls' school, which I didn't particularly want because I'd been brought up in convents and so on in Ireland and hated the whole, you know, but anyway, it wasn't to do with, obviously wasn't to do with the girls. So I had a good time, except I worked for a head who was completely toxic, who was a complete bully, who was a nightmare. I mean, I have written about it many times, if you, you know, written about my experience with that. And basically, if I had to get out, otherwise she would have killed me, really. She really would have destroyed me. The biggest, you know, there was a lot of issues. Once I became a bit more, less dependent on her and independent, she turned against me. She had all the sort of male characteristics, really. And the big issue, the big thing happened when I got shortlisted for, I started applying for headships just for the sheer hell of it. I had the letter ready. I thought, I'll have a go. And I rang her up to say, I got an interview. And this was a big school with a big salary. There was no way they were going to appoint me, but they shortlisted me. And to me, that was good enough. So I rang her up. There was a death silence on the end of the phone. She'd applied as well. And she was she was shortlisted. Well, she was disgusted. Absolutely disgusted. And she made my life a misery, trying to get me to drop out. And I said, look, I'm not going to get the job. I just want the experience to see what a headship interview looks like. Yeah. Well, and again, that week, and everything was against me. That week then there was a, I'd been doing something with the kids, I can't remember what it was, and there was a big double page spread in the TES. And it was all over, it was Kenny Frederick said this, Kenny Frederick said that. And I said, but you wouldn't come out and even talk to the reporter. And that's, you know, it was no, she wouldn't have anything to do with that. She wasn't interested in kids, really. But according to her, I'd set this up to sort of put myself on a platform that was on the same as her. I mean, you know, it's farcical. I could tell you about that for ages. She bullied me at the interview. She was just a nightmare. Anyway, so eventually then, so we came back, got over that. She didn't get the job either. And then I was given the option to go and support a school as a deputy head. There was in terrible trouble, a boys' school over in Hammersmith. And I just grabbed it. I said yes, because otherwise it was just going to go from bad to worse. And there, I mean, it was tough and it really taught me a lot because it was a head who'd taken over a school that was in such serious trouble. The previous head who'd left it like that had gone off with his pension, everything intact, his room, and the school was just a nightmare. And this poor head really was set up. And I went in to support him, but it was just firefighting. It was just a nightmare. But I learned a lot. I learned a lot when I was there. He, of course, was ousted, as they do, when Ofsted then failed the school. But anyway, in the meantime, I've been applying for headships and I got my job at George Green's in the Isle of Dogs, which I was there for 17 years. And that was it was a tough job. It was a very strange area. I'd always worked in inner city London. You know, used to multiculturalism, you know, we were right on there.
Yeah.
Because you go to the Isle of Dogs and it was a very different, it was completely different.
Oh, really?
You know, oh, yeah, completely. Yeah, you know, it was very strange. The whole history of the Isle of Dogs, if you look at it, you know, they declared UDI at one point. And it was a sort of a large, about 50% white British population and about 30, 40% Bangladeshi, and then a mixture of others. It sort of changed over time, but the in-your-face racism was like nothing I'd ever seen before. I was quite horrified, you know, coming from parents, whatever. So, you know, that was, it was a tough job, but, you know, I managed to get a great, hang on, sorry, turn this phone off. Sorry, are you there?
Yeah.
Decline, okay. So it was a really sort of tough job, but I developed a great team about around me. People were really good and helped. And we had some tough times with Ofsted. We had racist riots in the street. We had people die in it, children die. You name it, it happened. And it was very, very tough, but I loved it. So it was really good.
And then...
Sorry, I forgot. Yeah. So when I left there, because I thought, well, I got to, I was about 61. I thought, well, I should go and give somebody else a go. And I went off for my sins to be, do a PhD. And that was a real lesson for me, because I always say I'm not academic, although I've done two master's degrees when I was working, but no memory of them. I don't know. Anyway, so got this PhD. Somebody persuaded me to do this PhD. And it was great for me. It was around teacher rounds, which are peers observing each other. And to me, it was about working alongside, my research involved me working alongside teachers in the classroom. And I realized that teachers sometimes, and I was a very inclusive head. My head was like, my office was like Piccadilly Circus most of the time. But people tell you what they think you want to hear. Whereas when you work inside them, when I was doing research on teacher rounds and talking to people, I realized, you know, they told me everything. And I was quite horrified about the anxiety, the stress, the feeling of being done to rather than being done with. And these, let's face it, the schools that let me in were nice schools. You know, there wasn't a fear, but nobody wanted to upset anybody or nobody wanted to be resistant or whatever. Yeah. And that was a great lesson for me, you know, and made me think about what I would do differently. I did write an apology to myself at that point. I did say, no, I'm sorry about putting you through such, you know.
It's really interesting that, isn't it? Because I feel like lots of staff, people who I work with or leaders say, you know, they want to be, they want staff to be able to be open and honest with them, and they've got an open door policy. But often staff don't feel like they can be really honest with leaders, do they? Like you're saying, they say what they feel like they should be saying and actually don't tell the truth about how they're feeling and what's going on in the school.
They don't, because they want to be seen, because they care so much about their job, they want to be seen as being on top of it and doing well. And actually a lot of the head teachers I'm talking to at the moment are the same. They won't say they're struggling because they don't want to be seen as struggling. They want their leaders to think well of them. They want to do a good job. And, you know, I after my sort of research, if teachers had hair shirts, they'd wear them because they beat themselves up all the time. It's never good enough. And, you know, I've seen some cracking stuff going on, yet they still beat themselves up. And it's, but people don't say what they're feeling. So for me, that was a big lesson, which I tried to pass on to other head teachers and so on, you know.
Yeah, I think it, I think teachers and leaders as well, like you're saying, they don't want to admit that they're struggling because because nobody is. Often they feel like it's just them. It must be just me who feels like I can't cope with this amount of work or with this workload or whatever it is.
And it is getting a bit better.
Yeah.
Now. And people talk about mental health and workload. Yeah. And so on, it is getting a bit better, but it's even quite a big thing. And as I say, just I've been talking to head today, and I said, have you told your chair of governors, have you told your whatever COE or whatever, CEO or whoever, line man, and no, have you told your senior team? I used to tell everybody everything.
Yeah,
I think we have to share how we're feeling, and that's how you survive. You know, I would tell people, I was the honest truth about what was happening. Yeah. And I think that's a really important thing, lesson for me. People used to come and check on my well-being to see, was I okay? And that could have been the cleaner, it could have been the, you know, one of the TAs, one of the, you know, because I shared what was going on, not in a pathetic way or, you know, oh dear me, I don't know what to do, but just because schools are full of people, it's all about relationships.
Yeah.
And so the advice I give to people is to share.
I think when I went through what I went through, and regular listeners will know what that is, because I probably talk about it way too much in terms of my burnout. But my head teacher said to me at the time, is it something I've done? And it absolutely was something that he'd done.
Did you say
he was with me? No, because I think it's so difficult to speak truth to power. If I could go back, having gone through what I've done and built my own business, I feel much more confident in who I am and what I do now. Yeah, I would absolutely say, yes, it is. You've done this. It made me feel like this. And but I think people feel it's very difficult to speak truth to power. And I don't mean that in like that we are powerful people as leaders, but that's the way that people see you if you're in a leadership position often, that they should defer to you and that you're the leader, because we've created these hierarchical leadership and then I think it becomes more difficult when you've got those types of structures for people to be honest.
But for me, the big, you know, other thing, and here was, I was deputy head, the three deputy heads. We were all bullied at different times, and she set one of us up against the other at different times. It was that the abused child. It took us a long time to actually talk about it.
Yeah.
And then to confront it. And I can think, why did we not involve the unions? Because you knew if a union person came in, you would be toast. She would just, you know, your life would be misery.
Yeah.
I did was, you know, and I had to prepare myself. I've done lots of work on assertiveness, which I think really helped with, you know, anybody out there, learn assertive communication.
Yes.
But what happens is that if the person doesn't want to hear it, and if they're not going to hear it, but what I did was I said what I had to say, you know, eventually, and I wrote it down. It didn't make any difference to her. And so I had to go, and when I went off to do this to comment, or when I went off to be ahead, you know, there wasn't, nothing. And what really made me very cross at the time, because we were one of the first schools to do investors and people, and it really galled on me that we could have investors and people and yet have the head as a bully, but none of us said anything. And I, you know, I wasn't only, you know, hey, she would send us out to bully other staff, which of course we tried not to do, but that was the atmosphere, and she got away with it. And you know, she then went on to teach teachers how to be heads, you know, one of those programs that you did or whatever. So, and it's still, you know, practically therapy, and I do it about writing, because I've written about it a lot to try to sort of work it out in my head. Why didn't we report her? But the chair of governors was terrified of her. The local authority, I don't think would have done anything else really. But I mean, really my answer was I just had to go. And sometimes it is.
And it's, I think one of the reasons I feel like that as well, that there are toxic schools, and I don't, this is going back quite a long time for you, isn't it? But it's the high stakes accountability culture that we live in has created the pressure, the stress. It's like a pressure cooker environment, isn't it? Where heads, necks are on the block, aren't they? If you know, if you don't achieve these results, or Ofsted come in, and I know you do work with headrests, so can you tell us about that? I've got about 300 different questions I need to ask here based on what you just said, but tell me about headrest first and the work that you do with them.
Headrest, a couple of colleagues set it up and asked me if I'd like to be involved, and I did. And I said, of course, you know, anything I can do, I always try to help my fellow heads. I was always, you know, a good listening ear. And so they set it up, and they set up the website, and, you know, and really I just join in. At the moment, there's four of us, but we're bringing in other people. Lots of people have offered help, experienced heads, and we do that. And basically, so we just take, message comes in either on the answer phone or on a DM to the on Twitter. And there's people, all sorts, who are feeling totally overwhelmed, because this has been the toughest term. So it hasn't just been about Ofsted. Ofsted is just one thing. So it has been, you know, we set it up particularly during COVID, because people were very much on their own. And particularly small schools, those heads of small schools, often one minute they've been the year six teacher and suddenly they're the head. They got no deputy, no senior leadership team. They're teaching, they got no money, and yet they're supposed to organise all of this. And so there's been all sorts of, but you know, large secondaries, people just feel that they can't do it. They're beating themselves up. And staff, whereas I think during the COVID, people came together very much and sort of worked, and so did parents. And of course, now then people are getting a bit more agitated. They're tired as well. Staff are tired. Parents are getting niggly and making, you know, complaints about this, that and the other. Nothing really. But, you know, all of that takes time and wears you down. And staff, you know, not quite as, depends on the school, not as as willing to come together and complain anymore. And then, of course, the threat of Ofsted. And of course, but if you're in an outstanding school, now I have to be honest, I've never been in outstanding anything in my life. But, you know, the fear then that they'll lose that. And I said, but look, the writing's on the wall. There's very few schools going to be outstanding. And I, you know, to me, I just think it's I don't know, it's a very strange thing. When we were doing our peer observations at the teacher rounds, realised that actually five people could go into a class and see something completely different.
I've always said that's an exact science.
Also, you know, the fact that if you're an inclusive school, and thankfully the work I do now for the inclusion quality mark takes me into schools all over the country, which is fantastic. They're doing amazing stuff, including children, but very few of them will ever be outstanding because it brings your results down and whatever. It's a really, you know, inclusion's really hard. People are still doing it.
He's on Twitter and he always comes across as a really great head. And I think he'd had Ofsted in, and the Ofsted inspector had said something like, well, if you keep having all these SEN children, you know, had basically said,
what do you expect?
Try not to have so many SEN children or whatever. Yeah. And I was so disgusted by that, because the idea that you wouldn't be inclusive so that you could change your Ofsted grade is absolutely appalling.
But the saddest thing is that there are many heads and many are lauded all over the place, and, you know, your sirs and your dames and your whatever, not all of them, and then, you know, and I'm not saying this everybody, but who actually get to that position because they don't admit those kids. Or they will say, well, you'd be better off down the road. We don't really have to. If you go to that school down there, you know, we suffered from that. Not suffered, victims of your own success. Yeah. But, you know, if you're a parent, you know whether you're welcome in a school or not, don't you? Whatever the admission policy says, you know whether you're welcomed. So that's what we talked about. Lost the track. What was it?
Well, I think we were talking about headrest.
Yeah,
and one of the things that I do want to pursue Ofsted a little bit with you, because at the moment I cannot believe I just can't believe that Ofsted are still going into schools and doing inspections when staff are under so much pressure and heads and senior leadership teams. And I think there's a huge irony in that Ofsted are now including well-being as an aspect of their inspection.
I know, crazy,
and yet they're causing so much stress.
And they won't listen, you know, because they're saying, well, people are saying it's very supportive. There's no unearthly way it's supportive. Even if you come out of it shining and full of glory or whatever, it's not supportive. It's, you know, the stress it causes on everybody in the school, you know, kids, staff, everybody, is just enormous, especially the head. So there's no way it is supportive. It is somebody judging you. And when I was working with teachers on my research, and when they told me is they love, you know, being observed by their colleagues who understand what it's like. They can have a proper conversation about teaching and learning. They know what, they're very reflective. They know what they want, have to improve, or they want to improve.
Yeah.
Somebody coming in who you don't know where they've come from, whatever, telling you about whatever it is, absolutely makes no difference. What it does happen is a lot of heads are being removed from post. And this is a big worry for me, because I'm a governor also in a couple of schools, in that sometimes heads aren't getting the support of their governors, they're not getting the support of their directors of education, or if in their MAT, they're just suddenly sidelined because the school has gone into a measure. Now, I've been in this position my school went into an RI, a real one, whatever it was, a category, which nobody expected. It was about three, I think we'd had three inspections afterwards. But I mean, you know, you just feel like you're going to die.
Yeah.
You feel such a failure. Now, I would have resigned there and then, but my governor supported me, the staff supported me, but more importantly, the director of education, it was Kevin Collins, you know, Kevin Collins, Czar, whatever.
Oh, yes.
Came down to see me and said to me, you know, you mustn't resign. You know, this is wrong. You've got to just fight back, which we did. And then sort of got all our energy together. So I know what that feels like. And I can remember sitting in my office when this horrible inspector, because you could tell he hated me. For some reason, people either like me or hate me, and he hated me. And you could tell. And he was sort of, oh, he was just nasty. And I remember sitting in my office and everybody was out doing everything, trying to make sure the schools all were, I had nobody I could talk to. Couldn't sit, sitting in my office, and I sat there for about an hour and a half, because people thought I wasn't, you know, an inspector or whatever, didn't want to disturb me. I'm thinking, where do we go from here? So it is, it's the worst imaginable thing that can happen to you as a head, because you take it personally, you think it's going to affect everybody in the school and whatever. You know, we recovered and we were fine, you know, and you look back and you get over it. But it's horrible. And I, you know, I just feel for colleagues. So when we're talking to people in hairdress, we know we've been there. We've been through some terrible, all of us in our roles as heads in challenging schools, know, you know, all the different things that happened to us. So it's, yeah.
So I find it's, when, like you're talking about the power of the emotions and the feelings that go with it, we were in the last school I worked in, we were outstanding and hadn't had an Ofsted inspection for 15 years, I think it was, maybe 2007. No, it was probably 10 or 11 years. So we knew. But because of that, the staff were just quite on edge all the time.
Yeah,
and keep mentioning Ofsted. In my opinion, as a leader, I think you don't... You don't do things for Ofsted. You do things for the children. And when you get things right for the children and things are working, Ofsted can come in and see it, and they'll see what you do.
Well, you'd hope.
Yes.
You'd hope, because you don't know who's going to walk in that door. You don't know what anybody experiences. You know, if you've come, and I don't want to sort of denigrate any sort of school, but wherever you come, whatever your mindset is, it's very hard to leave that behind. Mine was a very different sort of school. You know, we were including children with a wide range of needs. Now, if you'd come in and actually thought these children ought to be elsewhere, you're going, you know, that's what you're going to get. If, or whatever they think, you know, they make comments on the way staff were dressed. And I sort of made a comment back, well, I said, I don't care what they're dressed, as long as they're good teaching. That was sort of a point against me. So it depends on who they are and whether they're willing to work with you, and whether they actually see the full picture. And because they come in for a short time, now they don't want to see bits of paper. They often don't want to listen. So it depends. When I had my last inspection at the school, I had a lead inspector who listened and was, you could tell, understood what we were doing. But it's a bit of, that's the gamble.
And yeah, it's a Russian roulette, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And the new framework really isn't helpful to anybody. So, you know, it's terrifying, because you as the head, you want to make sure you're steering your school in the right direction. But of course, you know, as a teacher, you remember, kids pick up on your fear, don't they? I remember, you know, the GCSE class, and they'd be coming in and you'd be saying, to, you know, come on, we've got to do it. He said, miss, it'll be all right. It'll be fine. You know, but the kids get it. They pick up on your stress. Of course, staff pick up on it, and everybody does. So try not to do that. And, you know, just to say, well, we're just doing this for the kids, even though you've been directed. And even more so since I left now, far more directives about, you know, they've got to have a new phonics, you know, scheme. They've got to have this, whatever. How dare they? How dare they? You know, it's the heads decide, you know, what is right for them. And that feeling you're being done to leaves you feeling powerless. Now, I say to heads, in our control as a head, you can, you know, not try not to do things to people. do them with them.
Before we find out more from Kenny about how you can do things with staff rather than to them, I'd like to tell you a little bit about our partner, Head Teacher Chat. Head Teacher Chat discusses lots of topics, from how to support pupils with learning, how to support parents, and the many issues that come with leading a school. The aim of Head Teacher Chat is to support head teachers and school leaders who are in a challenging and often lonely role. They do this by offering lots of information for schools to tap into. For example, they have lots of fantastic education companies on their database for leaders to discover, as well as leadership templates to download. They've written product reviews for leaders who are looking for products for their school. And this year, they've even launched the very first school leader planner, especially designed to help leaders to be productive and organised. If you'd like to hear more about Head Teacher Chat, you can find them on their website at www.headteacherchat.com. Head Teacher Chat, it's what head teachers are talking about. Now let's get back to the interview.
So let them decide and let them be involved in it, and all the research says that actually well-being is whether people feel empowered, whether they feel part of the big picture. So not policies are just dropped on them or a curriculum dropped on them. They need some autonomy. They need to be trusted, and that's a big issue. My thesis, if you ever want to read it, only 85,000 words. I've written a few articles you read, but it was about the lack of trust in schools, and I can understand that. Because I always say to school, when I'm in and out of schools, I say, look, you know, you're in a good position. You don't need three, you know, whatever observations a year and work school, whatever. Give that time to let teachers observe each other and to learn from each other. You'll learn just as much by going in and taking the class and, you know, talking to them about what they've been learning and whatever. Do it differently. Why are we doing things the way? It's an old model. And, you know, we all know if there's a teacher in the school that's struggling. Everybody knows. You don't need this whole
It's really interesting because my sister, she still works in the school that I worked in, and she was being observed the other week, and I said, oh, how did your observation go? And she said, you know, she's an amazing teacher, like she is 10 times the teacher I will ever be. She teaches PE and she's absolutely brilliant. I said, how did your observation go? She said, yeah, it went well, I got good feedback. And he said to me, basically, you know, you're a shit hot teacher. The kids were eating out of your hand and blah, blah, blah. And I think he actually struggled to give her some targets for how to improve. And then she was observed another three times in the same week. It was part of the timetable that was, and I just thought, I've said this before, you don't fatten a pig by weighing it. You know who your good and outstanding teachers are. And I think, you know, you should be, I think sometimes though you have to find the right balance, because sometimes in some schools outstanding teachers, if you want to use that terminology, are the best teachers, can sometimes be left, and then
said to this, if you're a good teacher you're left alone. You might be given an NQT to mentor or a trainee, but actually they leave you alone. And actually a good teacher is somebody who's all the time trying to improve. Yeah. You know, if you stand still, you sink. And all the evidence is that after 5 years, we go downhill as a teacher. Yeah. Now that's not a bad thing. What it means is, and that includes SLT, that you've got to keep reinventing yourself. You've got to think of new ways. You've got to reflect, work with others. And I will say the best teachers are probably in your school. And it's not about being the best or the worst, because nobody's outstanding all the time, whatever that means. Sometimes it's just good enough. Kids don't, you know, fine, give us a rest. Stop the awe and wonder. Let's just, you know, get on with it. And that's the way it should be. So, and people also said that during my research, teacher said to me, sometimes when we're sent to see, so somebody, you know, on your target, it says, well, you know, your questioning isn't as good as it should be or whatever it is. And they're sent off to see the best practitioner on questioning, who's all singing, dancing, whatever it is. And they're saying, they come back from that and they feel daunted because they think,
I could never be like that. Yeah, no, I always think that.
Different personality, different subject, and it puts them off. We're actually just seeing practice. And then having a chance to talk about it, and what they see, what they feel, what they hear, getting rid of all that jargon lingo or, you know, jargon is really important. And that's what teacher rounds are about, getting people to really talk about what they've seen, what they heard. Because not only are they feeding back to the person whose lesson we've seen on what they want us to feed back on or whatever. But having that discussion, because you're reflecting on your own teaching at the same time.
Yeah.
And it's far more powerful. But we're still in schools doing things the way we've always done them. And a lot of heads live in fear of the local authority, the map, whoever. And I can understand if they're there by the way that everything's so fractured. Whereas, you know, we're in a better position to actually argue back and to actually do what you felt is right. We still lived in fear and still did a lot of those things just to make sure we got through Ofsted. And I used to say to my staff, if we want to be an inclusive school, we have to make sure we keep our grades up and, you know, all that sort of stuff. If we want them to leave us alone, to a certain extent, we've got to play the game. So it's complicated.
It's sad that, isn't it? That you have to play a game. Just coming back to what we were saying then as well, I think that what Ofsted has caused is the, I think people think that there's a tick list as well, like education as a tick list or teaching as a tick list. So in lots of schools, they develop lists of, well, this is what we expect to see in an outstanding lesson or a good lesson. And I think then staff go, well, tell me what outstanding looks like. And do a training session on an outstanding lesson. Yeah, yeah. And I would always say to my head, you can't do that, because teaching is, you can't pin it down. It's an individual thing. It's something that comes from within. It's not something that you...
But there's people making a fortune on that, running these acts. And listen, education is full of tick lists. You know, one school, I remember going into, because I always have a thing about learning walks as well, because my big lesson, we've done a course in my school on learning walks, which were designed by someone called Richard Elmore in America, which was about a big picture about taking it, basically sort of finding out one thing might be about oracy in year eight or whatever. So you take a group of walkers and you take them out and you give a global feedback. You go, there's a protocols, there's a way of talking about, you get people out of their own classrooms to come and walk with you. So you're talking about what you've seen, what you've heard. I mean, it's a really good thing to do. But I, as I discovered to my horror on that fateful Ofsted, when the lead inspector came in and said, I'd like to come and do a learning walk with me, Mrs. Frederick. And I thought naively, lovely. I know what's a learning walk. No, what they wanted me to go in and in 3 minutes then make a judgment on what I was seeing. That's what it was about. And it's turned now into learning walks and monitoring walks. And I'm saying to schools when I'm going in with them, look, divide it up. If you want to do a monitoring walk, name it a monitoring walk so staff know what it is you're looking for. If it's a learning walk, do it properly. I'll send them the PowerPoint. Here's how you do it. Quite easy. You can involve kids. You can involve people, get people out of their subject areas to see what's happening. You know, whatever. Involve governors, do all sorts of things. So it's, I just think it's an important thing that people, things have been hijacked for the wrong reasons. And a learning walk should be a learning walk, not a monitoring one.
Yeah.
I know the point I was trying to make. Sorry, I'd gone into one school and you know, you said the tick list. Well, because I'd been there the year before, we talked about learning walks, and so they'd showed me a sort of a little card they'd made that they were going to leave with the teacher after they'd been in, and it had about six things to tick on. So, of course, what the teachers did, they made sure that whatever those six things you get a tick on, that they were doing, and that's what people told me in my research. They know what is being looked for, and then they play the game and they plan the lesson accordingly. It's not a real lesson, and they do it. But then when they start doing that for learning walks as well, or the monitoring walks, and I just say to them, I said, look, it's a nice idea. They wanted to give it to someone to say, you know, well done or whatever. But actually, they were just then gearing themselves up to be able to tick off everything on that list. And in my research, all the teachers I work with said they hate tick lists.
And then they lead to generic things that staff are being told they can do to improve their lesson. Because if there's something missing on the tick list, well, then that's your target, the thing that's missing on the tick list. And in actual fact, I mean, I do coaching in school, so we do peer-to-peer coaching. So, and for me, that's the most effective way of helping teachers to, become aware of...
That's what teacher rounds basically is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you become aware yourself from the conversations that you have and from someone's, when I say observations, I don't mean monitoring them. Just the things that they've seen and the things that they've noticed, and they'll say, I saw this, I noticed that. Did you see this?
And what you felt.
Yes.
And that's, and then you can have an open discussion. And when you're having, you need protocols around those discussions. So there's confidentiality and so and not judgmental language, because that's the whole fear of them is the judgment.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter how many positive sandwich bits you put in, nobody hears them. They go straight for the areas for development.
I actually say, you know, when you're having the conversation about the lesson, to not include any judgmental words at all. So even praise, because
I know, it's a hard one to stop them.
Very difficult. I've got a one-to-one coaching session, and then in my planning for the day, I've got to listen to someone having a coaching conversation with someone, and then I'll be having a conversation with him about it. And one of the things, like going right back to when we first started doing the peer-to-peer coaching, that he struggled with is not saying good, perfect, you know, and giving those, like, even those little indicators judging something, that it's not.
I had to give up on that when we were feeding that, and I realized it's actually because teachers are so used to hearing negative things.
Yeah.
When they were supporting each other, they couldn't but say that was amazing or whatever. I really liked it, and I try and stop. You know, eventually I just gave up on it and say, you know, fair enough. But what they did was they would sometimes, it was an even better if, or there might have been something that they might try or whatever. But because they developed these sort of little learning communities, there was real trust and they really listened. Where they said to me, they don't listen to their senior leaders because they've never seen them teach. They don't know if they what sort of teacher they are. They might occasionally, they may like them personally, but they don't know. So somebody come in, and I think back to myself, you know, going to see, and I said, sorry, my very good friend who was a maths teacher, brilliant maths teacher, she's, and I would go in and observe a lesson and be telling her how to teach maths. I haven't a bloody clue.
No.
You know, or, you know, somebody going in to tell someone how to teach in early years, which is a really specialist area. So, you know, we need to look at ourselves, really. But actually, when they're listening to each other and talking to each other, and it's often about kids, one of the things when you go in and they teach around, the teacher tells us what we want, particularly what they want us to look at. Doesn't mean we can't look at anything else. But there might be particular children they're wondering about why they're not making the progress. And because we're in the room, we can sit near them and sort of eavesdrop. And, you know, it's fascinating. So it's often about the kids are doing, teacher has a notice. And I give one example of a brilliant teacher in a school. And this was actually when I was doing this as a consultant rather than a researcher. And she'd been couldn't figure out why these two girls were not making progress, very bright, etc. She was an amazing teacher, big room. And I was sitting listening. Do you know the girls spent an hour talking about their eyebrows? I kid you not, their eyebrows. And we laughed and we talked about it. And because every time she'd come near them, they'd go, oh, miss, you know, we just stuck on this bit. We couldn't. And then she'd come and she'd explain it all again. She was wearing herself out. And they'd go back to talking about eyebrows. So it's those funny things you've got to be able to laugh at. Kids can fool us, you know, and having more people in the room. But you've got to have that trust. And they learn to trust each other, which they don't, they're not trusting the senior leaders.
Yeah.
And that's something we have to take on board. And it's often just because of the hierarchy. We're awash with hierarchy.
And I guess, you know, that comes full circle back to Ofsted, because like you're saying, schools don't trust Ofsted, because I think going back to what you were saying before, my experience sometimes was that the Ofsted inspectors had made their judgment before they actually came into the school. So nothing that we did or said would have changed what they were thinking. How do you think Ofsted inspections, or how could Ofsted build more trust? How would you still have Ofsted?
I don't know. I mean, I remember the days before Ofsted, and I can remember days when we did what we liked, which wasn't always a particularly good thing. So there probably is a place for Ofsted, but people need to recognise what it is. It's not a supportive process. You know, I can remember the days when we were at HMI, which was probably, you know, a more supportive thing. You know, they keep reinventing these different frameworks, whether it's just, and they're saying it's reassuring parents. But, you know, I don't know if you're a parent, I'm a parent, I'm seeing my grandchildren now. And actually, what you want is those kids to bounce into school every day, love learning, and you know, and I'm really enjoying it. That's what parents want. Yes, of course, they want to imagine, they want to be able to read, but they're not into that thing. And when I go into schools now, you know, and I say to even in a primary school, you know, did the whole world fall apart because you didn't do SATs? I said, no, it was fantastic. They were able to extend their learning. They were able to really go into things in depth. The learning that went on when we'd no SATs last year was phenomenal. Whereas again, we're back into preparing the kids for the SAT, all this test papers and all the rest of it. And actually, if we want kids to love learning, we've got to do something different. So it needs to be, I'm sure there's a place for Ofsted as part of a system, but not this great big brother, we're going to come in and judge you. There's enough people judging us. And I think we're harder on ourselves than anybody else is. So whether there's a place for it, but the present framework, and in fact, you know, I'm totally disillusioned. I honestly would go back to the days when we had them in for 4 days, because at least then you had time to talk, you had time to explain things, you had time to read things, you had subject inspectors, you know, it was a big operation and you knew they were coming, you know, probably too expensive, but at least that you were more likely to get a fairer judgment than these snapshot visits.
Yeah, it's interesting that, because that links in with what you were saying as well about, I mean, I'm an English teacher, so going into maths lessons for me and trying to judge the quality of learning that was going on in a maths lesson was just not possible. I mean, I did try to judge it on, especially if it was, you know, top set GCSE maths, could I learn this effectively? Because I probably didn't have a clue most of the time what was going on around me. But to have subject specialists and the importance of subject knowledge to effective teaching, I just think cannot be underestimated. And in so many schools, there's, I know that the importance of pedagogy is key, and you need to have a CPD program that helps staff to improve. But if that CPD program is missing subject knowledge and departments are not spending time talking to each other and discussing their subject and thinking about how they can teach it best and how it links in to what the school wants to focus on, then I think you're on a hide into nothing. The subject is so key in a secondary school, or like you're saying, in a primary school with phonics and
with schools now, God love them, you know, they have to, everybody's going to be a subject lead, doesn't matter what their degree or what they're in, suddenly you're the maths lead or you're the English or you're the geography lead. They have to be they've imposed a secondary model on primary, and it isn't, I'm nothing against knowledge, you know, whatever, this whole emphasis on memory, you know, there was someone on Twitter sort of saying the kids have been asked to name the British values, for God's sake. So that got us into a very silly argument about, you know, lying, cheating or whatever, because that's what we're thinking about British values. But to ask a young child or, you know, those sorts of questions and testing them out and on their memory. Now, I've nothing against people learning spellings and learning knowledge, but this whole emphasis, it's like things have been imposed. So new phonic systems imposed, new reading systems imposed, this whole bit about subject knowledge. So schools, primary schools, are developing this, poor subject leaders have to gather, learn this knowledge, then impart it to their colleagues so that they can teach it. Imagine having to teach 10 different subjects. It's crazy. What do we expect? So imposing that model, a secondary model, on a primary school, to me, is not right. And that needs rethinking. But we're getting too much central control, I think. You know, the people who know, they're trying to change the curriculum in early years, trying to make that more formal. You know, when everybody knows actually that actually learning through play, you know, I'm always fascinated by what goes on in early years. I'm full of admiration. How they get those kids sitting on the carpet listening, you know, must be like herding cats. You know, they get them to routines. It's amazing. And I'm seeing it from the other side for my grandchild, who's 4 at the moment. And we thought, God, how's he going to get on? Because he's a bit of a character. Loves it. You know, whatever the teacher says, Miss Cunningham is God to whatever. Miss Cunningham says it, that's what. I mean, it's just amazing the way that he's doing his phonics. He's like, you know, so you see it from the other side as well. And I work a lot in primaries, and I'm actually a governor in two primaries. So those early years teachers, I think we as secondary teachers have such a lot to learn from them, the way they plan for the individual, they assess the individual, they join plan, you know, it's fascinating. And, you know, full of admiration. Yet someone at the DfE, never been in a bloody school, trying to decide, this is what we want. Well, you're not going to keep people in a job. Remember I said about professionalism, that's what well-being, all the research says that if teachers, if their professionalism is respected, and they're trusted to do their jobs, that's what keeps them in a, nobody comes into this job to be told, here you are, teach that, assess that way, this is how you manage behavior, whatever. We're professionals, let us do that job and let schools together. And what I love about schools is the collaborative nature. And I say to people, you can't do it on your own. And when I'm having conversations with headrest, teachers are ringing, head teachers, you can't, you need a headship team. You need to have people around you so you can support each other. Nobody knows the answers. You know, I was never a detailed person, I was a big picture. I had people there who could support me, who were really good, said, that's a great idea, Kenny, but have you thought, or yeah, whatever. But we shared our woes, we shared our worries, and that is what kept me in a really tough school for 17 years. And I owe a lot to those people. But, you know, we supported each other. And I know different teams in school, people really support each other. They plan together. They have honest conversations with each other. And that's the way. So the job is too big to do by yourself, either, you know, as a head, senior leader, or a teacher.
Yeah. It's interesting because that's why I set up my group coaching program and why I've set up the Women Lead Well coaching network, because I think it's really important to have those networks and those spaces where you can bring, and like we're saying, sometimes people are not in a position yet to be vulnerable in schools, so, you know, to have that space to have a group coaching, the group sometimes, and the power of it, and how the women support each other and help each other and come along and say, this has happened, what would you do about it, I've tried this, I've tried that, I don't know where to go next, just to have that as a sounding board and the ideas, I think is so important, isn't it?
But you have to be that sort of person. Sometimes people feel, and perhaps it's a man thing, some again, and it's changing again, where you'd never admit you were in trouble, you'd never think you could ask anybody. I would always, and I always did throughout my career, pick up the phone and say to someone, look, I haven't got a clue, what do I do about this? It's a new head, there's so much comes your way to ask somebody, what do you, and they, people were quite happy to be asked, and I, you know, make sure I fulfill that role. And there is a big thing about women putting that ladder down for somebody else. You know, I had a really unfortunate experience with the head I worked for, who would kick that ladder away, took on male characteristics. And that's not the way, you know, we are who we are. We're women. We're emotional beings. Embrace it. You can be a different sort of leader, you know, really be a different sort of leader, set a different agenda. And to be men, I like quite like men. I married one.
Yeah. But,
you know, it's, you know, and I meet some great male heads as well, but they're inner confidence sometimes. And when I've interviewed men for senior posts, and I've interviewed for headships as well, you know, I've done a lot of interviews, sometimes the inner confidence, and I go into places sometimes where there's men running 1, 2, 3 schools, and there's women running around them doing the work. And I say to them, why didn't you apply? Why? Oh, I didn't think, I want to have a family or whatever.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, because there's one thing they can't do on that job description, they don't apply. So we really have to keep banging that and changing that mindset, supporting each other, because women can do it. You can have a family, you know, and it's great now when I do go into lots of problems where the head's off having a baby, and I think, woohoo, great. Yeah. You know, and then the day, you know, and people feel, some people at schools are family friendly, and then a lot more men now want to be involved in the childcare. So I'm seeing schools doing a lot of flexible stuff that, you know, actually recognize people have families, you know, where people are now not saying you've got to be in school at, you know, 6 o'clock and go home at 6 o'clock, you know, people, and the heads leading by example, you know, go home, you know, Harper's four or five or whatever, and go, and not, it's not that competition. So it is changing in many schools, and we've got to make sure we keep that so it's manageable.
Yeah, it's interesting that we've sort of come full circle, because right back at the start of the interview, I wrote down the word emotional and masculine/feminine leadership. And I think we're probably moving out to the other side of, you know, that feeling that we as women, we had to lead in a masculine way, because a lot of the characteristics that we bring to leadership as women are what make us such successful leaders, because we bring that emotional understanding and the empathy to it, don't we?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, schools are all about relationships, and women, we're good at developing relationships.
I'm not saying men aren't, don't get me wrong.
No, me neither. But, you know, we're good at that. We have to recognise it is that, you know, coming back to the imposter syndrome, I always felt like an imposter, and still often do sometimes when I'm going into schools thinking, you know, who's she, you know, who's this woman? But, you know, you have to just, it's having that conversation with yourself, having a sense of humour. And the schools and the heads of survival, you know, we used to, my team, sit down some days, and we'd had some horrible days, particularly when there's a lot of the racist stuff going on or whatever. And you had to think, and, you know, people would get called names. We'd sit down sometimes, we'd write up whatever we'd been called that day by often a parent or whatever, and think about, you know, what's that word? What does it mean? Is it legal? Could you do it? Or whatever. You had to have a laugh. You had to be able to say, this is ridiculous. Some of the things are ridiculous. And you have to just acknowledge that and be able to laugh with your team so that the next day you're able to go forward. And at the moment, this particular week, schools are at the moment just trying to get through day by day. And I know hopefully they have lots of kids singing and partying and, you know, just being kids, and the staff join in with that, because that's what it's all about. It's about the kids, it's about each other, but it's enjoying each other together, and that sort of community feel. And that's where schools should be.
What a great way to end the interview. That's fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Again, I probably could have talked to you all day, but I'm sure people will be taking so much away from that. So thank you. Have a great day.
My
Hopefully,
pleasure.
Sorry, yeah, go on.
You look after yourself, and, you know, keep doing what you're doing. And, you know, it's time to reflect, isn't it? It's a bit like therapy, this, sometimes,
yes.
Isn't it? When you think back, when you're too busy doing the job, you don't, you know, you get on with it, don't you?
Yeah, I think it's definitely been like therapy for me. Yes.
Yeah, keep in touch. And as I said, we keep an eye out and hairdressed, and, you know, we'll do what we can there to support each other.
So if people want to get in touch with you, find out more about Headrest, where can they do
just
that?
Just look on Twitter at headrest.uk. It'll come up. They're welcome to tweet me or contact me by email or whatever. Do you want to take my, or you can give me my email, I don't mind.
I'll if you send it to me, I'll put it on the show notes. So people
I will
can
do, yeah. And do my Twitter handle or whatever, they can DM me or whatever. I'm happy to talk.
Well, hopefully we'll get you on a future episode and chat to you again, Kenny. Brilliant. Thanks a lot.
Thank you,
you too.
Have
Bye.
A Christmas.
And to
Bye.
You. Bye.
Bye.
I absolutely loved that conversation with Kenny. She has a great approach to leadership, and there are quite a few things that I just want to pick out that I think she talked about. And they're not necessarily to do with Ofsted, actually. But one of the things she talked about as a leader, and I think this is becoming much more clear to me, is about having the best people around you. And I think that means having people whose strengths complement you, so that you can build a team in which everybody has the strengths so that you can have an impact. And sometimes that might mean acknowledging your weaker areas so that you're able to identify the best person to be added to the team. And that's important, because it's really important to be aware of yourself and to be aware of those areas where you are strong and the areas that you are less strong, and to be able to create a team around you whose strengths complement each other is really powerful. She also talks about not doing things to people, doing things with people. And that, for me, is one of the key elements of leadership, is to understand the people that you are working with and work with them in conjunction with them, that you're not always giving top-down directives. You're not making the decisions and then telling people what to do. Involve your staff in those decisions. It might take you a little bit longer to go through a process or to implement a project, but it will help you to get buy-in from staff if they feel like they have been part of the process, that they've been involved in those decisions that are being made about where the school is going and how the school is going to get there. So that's really important as well. She talks as well about honest conversations, and this is something that's come up quite a lot recently in my group coaching programs. We've talked about how an honest and open culture is really important, and we've also talked about how you achieve that as a leader, and that stems from you being a role model and being honest with people and providing them with honest feedback. Because if you don't do that for your staff, if you don't have those what are sometimes called challenging conversations with people, you will not find people come to you. So you have to be the role model in that honesty and openness. If that is your value and that is how you can live from your values, then you need to be honest in those conversations with other people and be prepared to have those honest conversations. And finally, Kenny said, the job of a head teacher is too big to do yourself. So you have to find the people who can help you to do the job effectively. I also think the job of a deputy head is too big to do yourself, probably assistant head, and it's really important that you build teams of people around yourself who can support you to achieve your objectives, to be able to achieve your strategic intent, and that is really important. So understand that often a job is too big to do yourself. You can't take it all on yourself. You have to bring in other people, and that often involves developing other people in your team, and that also links into awareness of others and understanding the strengths of your team, understanding the passions of your team, understanding what your team is interested in and where they want to develop, so that you can get them on board to help you to achieve your vision. And sorry, I said that was the last thing, but I'm actually going to say this one thing that she said, because this is really important to me. And she said, women are emotional beings, so embrace it. We're different. And I don't need to say any more than that. I think if you're a woman listening, you will understand that. And finally, I said last thing and I've given you two more, but you know, it's my podcast. So here we go. And she said, well-being is about whether people feel empowered, trusted and autonomous. And they are things that repeatedly come up on the show in the interviews that I do with prominent educationalists, very successful head teachers. Empower your staff, trust them and help them to feel autonomous. So thank you, Kenny, for all your wisdom and sharing your experience with us. It was really insightful, and I'm absolutely certain that the listeners are taking something of value away with them today. It was a brilliant interview. Thank you so much. So just to finish off, because that's all we've got time for today, if you would like to join, I have one place left in the run-up to Christmas. I have one place left on the Women Leaders Group Coaching Programme that will be starting at the end of January. So if you are interested in joining us on that, the feedback I've had so far from the four cohorts that I've done so far has all been tremendously positive. If you would like to join us on that, email me, vicky@weleadwell.co.uk, and we can book in a chat to see if it's something that will help you and support you on your leadership journey. So thanks for joining us. Have an absolutely brilliant Christmas. Have a rest. You deserve it. I know it's been the toughest term on record in education. So take the time for some rest, relaxation, spend time with your families, eat, drink and be merry. And I will speak to you again in the new year. Happy Christmas, everyone. Take care of yourself, take care of your staff, and lead well. This episode of the We Lead Well podcast was brought to you in partnership with Transform Education Coaching, headteacherchats.com, and the Teach Well Alliance.